Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19. Our guest, your guide, Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I thought maybe since we are now a little over a week out from the Thanksgiving holiday, we could kind of check in on trends. I was perusing the CDC's dashboard this morning. Emergency room visits involving COVID are up a little over 10%. Same goes for hospitalizations. This is just before the second wave of the holiday travel season. How does that rise in cases fit the curve from the past couple of years?
Well, the percent rise fits the curve for last year. It does not fit the curve for the year before. The year before was when Omicron was introduced and really just played havoc with the entire healthcare system, caused so many hospitalizations and tragically deaths. We didn't see that last year. We saw a lot of cases last year during the winter season, and we're just about, not quite where we were last year at this time in terms of the percent rising of cases. So this is what, frankly, everybody has been expecting, everybody in my field has been expecting, and that is that we're going to see a rise in respiratory disease after Thanksgiving. We actually started to see the rise before that with RSV and influenza a little bit and COVID. But we should continue, it's likely we're going to see a continued rise in these three through Christmas holiday through New Year's. And then sometime in January, hopefully things will peak. I think the only question is, what is going to be the zenith? What is going to be the top of this rise in cases? If we look at wastewater testing right now, it's high for COVID in most of the country, including California. So the wastewater data really portends what we're going to see in the next week to 2 weeks. So I think we can be pretty confident that the rise in COVID is going to continue. With a perspective on influenza, we're clearly entering influenza season. We're a little less than we were last year at this time when we had that very early surge in cases, but we are really entering influenza season. We're seeing a considerable amount of influenza nationally and in California and in the Bay Area. RSV is interesting. It's continuing to increase. It looks very much like last year with that big spike in RSV cases. There's some spotty areas around the country that suggest RSV may be peaking, but not here where we're still seeing a lot of cases. So RSV, influenza, and COVID, all three are increasing. Most of the hospitalizations, or the highest number of hospitalizations and deaths, are due to COVID, next influenza, and then RSV.
You know, something I should have brought up when we discussed reports of a surge in pediatric pneumonia in China is that in addition to the narrative you laid out of an emergency gap, people who didn't get prior exposure to diseases getting the diseases all at once because of the relaxation of China's zero COVID policy, there's a school of thought in circulation among some medical accounts on Twitter that what you're seeing both in China and to a lesser extent here with the surge in seasonal respiratory illness is not necessarily just an immunity gap, but perhaps a sign that prior infection with COVID has impaired immunity of people who got it. I was curious what you think of that narrative, if there is any evidence to support it.
Right. This has been postulated as a possible explanation. When we look at the basic science regarding COVID, The data to suggest that it impairs our immune system going forward is weak. That doesn't mean there isn't data. There have been some papers published, but not very many, and most of those papers have been refuted, both in terms of antibody production and in terms of T-cell response. Now, there are specific examples in rare cases where people do have some impairment, but generally speaking, that does not appear to be a sufficient explanation for what we're seeing in terms of the increased cases. So I think the take-home message at this point, where what our science is telling us, is that for the vast majority of people getting COVID, if not almost everybody, that long-term impairment of our immune system is probably not going on. Now, the reason why I keep using modifiers like probably is that our science is not nearly as deep and as strong as we would like. So we can only reflect on what we know right now. So bottom line, impaired immunity from COVID as a prolonged event to predispose you to more infectious diseases is purely a hypothesis with not an awful lot of evidence to support it.
Okay. At this point, we'll open it up to questions from our listeners. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And if you've got a question about things that afflict you through your nose or sinus passages, he might have an answer. The number is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. While folks hop on the phone lines, we'll start with a couple questions from the inbox. John wrote in from San Francisco, concerned about a roommate he just took on. John says he's 60 and he just found out the roommate has never been vaccinated, although the roommate says they have had COVID before. It's a long letter. I'm not going to get into the details of their relationship, but I think the pertinent question for John is, how much protection would John get from his roommate passing on COVID if the roommate got vaccinated? Or conversely, how much more vulnerable to infection by his roommate is John by virtue of the fact that the roommate's never gotten the vaccine?
Got it. The most of the cases of COVID we're seeing that result in hospitalization and death are in people who are not vaccinated. But, and that's where the vaccines really have their major impact in terms of protecting us against serious disease. I wish I could say that we get long-term protection against transmitting the disease, that is, we get long-term protection after getting vaccinated from getting infected and therefore being able to transmit it. But that just isn't the case. And it's not the case after having COVID. After having COVID or after being vaccinated, we do have good protection for a month, maybe 2 months, maybe even out to 3 months against getting infected. Not great, but we have good protection. But certainly after 3 months, and for most people, probably less than that, we don't have very much protection against getting reinfected or getting infected for the first time. So to John's specific question, if his roommate got vaccinated right now, probably through the next month, that is through the holiday season, it would be very unlikely, let me backtrack, 2 weeks after getting vaccinated, for the next month after that, it would be very unlikely his roommate would get COVID and be able to spread it to John. After that, all bets are really off. So bottom line, John won't get a lot of safety. He'll get maybe safety from his roommate for about a month, and that's really about it. This is a precarious time for John and for everybody, really, with, as we were talking about previously, with all these respiratory viruses, including COVID, circulating at higher numbers and going up, this is the time when we're going to see a lot of people getting COVID.
But the bottom line takeaway here, vaccination, at this point, more of a matter of protecting the person who's vaccinated from serious consequences of getting infected, rather than
That's
a
right.
matter of... preventing onward transmission of the disease.
That's right.
Hope that's helpful, John. Hopefully it smooths things over with your new roommate. Let's go to the phone lines. First up, we have Jeff in Orinda. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. I just had a quick comment, and that is, and I tuned in a little bit late, so I may have missed something, but I don't know what RSV is, and so it'd be helpful to, for me, and be helpful to name those things and rather than acronyms. And also, I heard comments about rising and increases, and it's very helpful to me to have some kind of quantification and percentages, for example, put on those things. That's all. Thank you.
Well, Jeff, sure thing. You make two excellent points. Nobody should talk with acronyms. RSV stands for respiratory syncytial virus. It's just such a mouthful that everybody just calls it RSV. This is a virus that we've known about for decades, but we haven't previously had anything much to protect us from it until now we have the vaccine. RSV primarily causes really serious disease in the very, very young, in infants and in people over 60. And it's a respiratory tract infection. In terms of increasing numbers, you're also absolutely right. Everything is relative. And so when we say a 10% increase, that sounds like a lot. We're seeing 10, 20% increase with COVID, for example. But it's an increase over relatively small numbers compared to the really dark days of the pandemic. To put that in perspective, we were having about 14,000 hospitalizations nationally from COVID about 3 weeks ago. Today, we're up to about 19,000 hospitalizations from COVID. And when I say today, that really reflects data from about 2 weeks ago. So the numbers are probably higher than that. So that gives you at least a perspective of where we're going. One other perspective on that is that at the height of the Omicron pandemic, we were having about 150,000 hospitalizations. So we're way below the really dark days, but we are going up.
And the trajectory matters as much as the absolute numbers, because you want to try to get a handle on where you're headed.
That's true, and it's an opportunity to say that it is so disappointing to see the United States and the rest of the world not only deciding that COVID is not a big deal, but deciding that it's not even worth collecting much data. So we're collecting so much data on the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations, the number of deaths than we were before. We're not doing as much analysis of the strains of COVID that we were doing before. And when I say before, January of this year. We're really much more in the dark about these numbers than we were before.
You know, Dr. Swartzberg, before we go to our next caller, on the topic of respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, I should pluck a question that hit our inbox from someone who signed their email MP. They say, quote, I scheduled an appointment at CVS for RSV vaccine, only to discover on the day of my appointment that my insurance wouldn't cover the $325 charge. Ends with a very big question mark of why. I'm assuming it's because this person is under 60 years old and therefore doesn't fall under the CDC guidance for who should get the vaccine. Do you happen to know how the vaccination program's going? Does it have to be prescribed for people who are within the eligibility categories?
Each private insurance company is going to have their own criteria. That said, that if the CDC recommendations are what almost all of the insurance companies follow. So if this is a healthy 30-year-old or 40-year-old, that doesn't fall into the category of where the CDC recommends talking to your doctor about getting vaccinated. So that may be the reason for MP not being able to get the vaccine paid for. it brings up a big topic of these vaccines should be available for people, and they should be available without having to pay the costs of them. I also, it's an opportunity to reflect on Paxlovid that now has cost, a five-day course costs $1,400 in most pharmacies. And that's just outrageous in terms of knowing that we have a drug that can treat COVID, but making it out of the reach of people who, for example, don't have the means to pay for it or the insurance to cover it.
Right, or even poor people with cheap insurance plans who have to share the cost of drugs.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go to Michael, who's on the line in San Francisco. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I was tested at Kaiser Hospital. I went in because my cold was bad. And this was Wednesday. I tested positive. The nurse practitioner seemed to think, because my cold had started the early beginning week of Thanksgiving, that I didn't need to quarantine myself, because we were anyway. So I tested positive at Kaiser last Wednesday. Then I self-tested at home Friday and again last night, and both times I tested positive. I did try to deal with the questionnaire I got from the Department of Public Health in San Francisco, and I sort of made a couple of errors. So at one point they seemed to think, it seemed to say if you're symptom free or whatever, you could not have to quarantine. The next time I did the same thing, it said I should quarantine until December 11th. Anyway, so I tested positive. I still have my cold. It's not as bad as it was right before Thanksgiving. And so
Michael,
questions are,
your question is, how long should you keep isolating?
Correct.
Okay.
Got it. Your story, Michael, when you were talking about it, when you used the word cold, and it's just an opportunity for me to impress upon everybody listening that COVID often presents exactly like a cold. And so people just are saying they have a cold. You're not doing that, Michael, but a lot of people are just saying they have a cold and they're not worried about it being COVID. That's really a big mistake. The second big mistake is that people often test as soon as they get sick, and oftentimes the home test is negative. And they'll say, well, it's just not COVID. It still could be, because oftentimes early on in the course, the home tests are negative. Getting to your question specifically, the CDC calls for isolation for 5 days after the beginning of your illness. On day six, you can come out of isolation, but if you're much better, nearly well, have had no fever. Between day six and day 10, you should wear a good mask, N95, KN95, for example, for the next 5 days until day 10. After day 10, you can come out of isolation. Not everybody agrees with that, that those recommendations are perhaps more liberal than they should be, because we know that people with COVID, even a mild case, if they continue to be symptomatic, they often test positive like you are on day 6, 7, 8, 9, sometimes even day 10 through 14. So I think that since you're still symptomatic, if you want to follow the CDC criteria, you should really be isolating through day 10. And I'm not sure, it's hard for me to go back and know exactly when you became ill, but I would plan on isolating through day 10 since you're still symptomatic. After that, even without testing, according to the CDC, you can come out of isolation.
It sounds like I'm having a hard time with the math as well. He said his first symptoms were the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, so he might be at day 10. But it seems like the most pertinent detail here is he took a home test. I assume that's an antigen test last night and tested positive. That means a relatively insensitive test picked up enough virus on the inside of his nose to show a positive line. Am I fair to think that would be a good reason to keep isolating?
You know, this is an area where we just don't have a lot of good science to guide us, and certainly not a lot of good public health advice to guide us. So everybody's doing it a little bit differently. I think that if you continue to test positive and you're symptomatic after day 10, I would remain in isolation. I've arbitrarily made a cutoff of day 14. If you're continuing to test positive and your symptoms are getting better, as Michael's are, even if you're testing positive, the chances of spreading this virus are probably very, very, very low. So at some point, we have to stop testing and just come out of isolation. And it depends upon whether you want to follow the CDC's criteria or be a little more conservative. And what may drive that decision may be who you're going to be around. If you're going to be around people at high risk of getting of having a bad outcome if they get COVID, you should be more conservative with those folks than in young, otherwise healthy people.
I mean, in my case, I had COVID. I got a round of Paxlovid and I got rebound after the Paxlovid. My tests were still turning positive until I believe day 16 from my first onset of symptoms. It just seemed easier. My understanding of the guidance was it was there to tell people when it was safe to, for instance, go back to work in the absence of the availability of frequent testing to tell whether or not they were transmissible.
That's right. The guidance is really there to try to find a balance between having enough, for example, healthcare workers and keeping everybody else safe and trying to find that sweet spot. And there's no way to do it for 330 million people. Your point about rebound is an important one. If people rebound, they are contagious again, and they're going to test positive with the home test almost always. So if you rebound, then you're back to day one, and that is, if you start to get symptoms again, that's day one, that's day zero, and then you start counting forward again that way. So if you rebound on, you're back in isolation for the first 5 days, and then you test again. And if you're much better, then you can come out of isolation, but still wear a mask for the next 5 days.
Dr. Swartzberg, the time is up. Thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.